Welcome to Modern Minds. I'm Mark Hennick. According to the Centers for Disease Control, nearly half of healthcare workers report feeling burned out. U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy wrote in an article for the New England Journal of Medicine that, quote, burnout manifests in individuals, but it's fundamentally rooted in systems. So today on the show, we're going to take a look at both sides of burnout, the individual manifestation and the systemic roots. My first guest is going to help us to unpack how it affects the people who work in the trenches of healthcare. Anna Schaffner is a burnout and executive coach. She's the author of Exhaustion, a History from Columbia University Press, and The Art of Self-Improvement, 10 Timeless Truths from Yale University Press. Her latest book is Exhausted, an A to Z for the Weary, and that's available everywhere now. Anna, thank you so much for joining us on Modern Minds today.
Thank you for having me.
So we're dealing with burnout among healthcare workers in particular, but let's start with exhaustion more universally, right? Because I think that this certainly isn't a new phenomenon, and it's not exclusive to healthcare workers. Now, in your book, Exhaustion, A History, your earlier book, you mentioned that exhaustion has at various times been, quote, pathologized, demonized, sexualized, and even weaponized. So can you give us maybe a little snapshot of the historical and cultural evolution of exhaustion and maybe what you meant by that?
Yeah, so often we think that our age is the most exhausting age ever. And in fact, that's a very common assumption. Everyone has always felt that way. We always tend to look back at the past and we think the grass is greener on the other side of history. We imagine the past as less tiring, less wearying, and we have a nostalgic, also a romantic vision of the past. But in fact, humans have always worried about exhaustion, and we can trace back concerns about the loss of our strength and energy and speculations about the causes of that energy loss all the way back to ancient China. So the good news is we are not alone. And I find that personally quite consoling. And I think that realizing that our energies are limited and that they wane as we age, and that as humans we worry about that energy depletion, is something that makes us profoundly human. We're not machines. And I think in the past, people always tend to tie up narratives about exhaustion with cultural criticism. So often we assign our exhaustion to factors, cultural development, social change that we worry about. So today we talk a lot about social media. We talk about new communication technologies always being on. We talk about the pressures of neoliberal capitalism. But in the past, people have worried about noonday demons, lukewarm, tepid faith, about female emancipation, about the malign influence of the planet Saturn, about the hustle and bustle of city life, too spicy food, overexciting novels, acceleration, and too much brain work. So in the history of exhaustion, we find that people tend to find external or internal causes for our exhaustion, and they create stories around what may cause our exhaustion. And they come up with lots of very interesting therapeutics from which we actually have a lot to learn.
I want to come back to that dichotomy in a second, but just to put a finer point on the concept of exhaustion, do you see exhaustion as sort of a binary in which either you're exhausted or you're not? Or does it maybe occur on a spectrum of degrees and burnout is at the end? What's sort of the current mental model of where burnout lives in the exhaustion framework?
Yeah, I would say that exhaustion is a symptom that resides in lots of different syndromes. So it's a symptom of burnout. It's also a symptom in ancient diagnoses such as melancholia or neurasthenia or achidia. And I would say that, as you said, Mark, that burnout is at the far end of the exhaustion spectrum. And exhaustion can come up in lots of different forms. It can be chronic, which is when we have to start to worry about it. But there's also a kind of natural exhaustion that can be cured by resting and by pauses, by holidays, by proper breaks. But the kind of exhaustion I'm interested in is the exhaustion that really depletes us, that cannot easily be cured by rest, and that is also a kind of exhaustion that has both inner and outer causes. And I think that's the kind of exhaustion that a lot of people experience and that a lot of people worry about.
So that inner and outer causes, you came back to that again. So I want to look more closely at that. I think the modern concept of burnout, it seems to almost fall into this sort of nature versus nurture debate, right? It's like, it's either all a matter of personal resilience or lack thereof, or a matter of your work environment. So where is exactly I guess you can call it the locus of control in burnout? Is it in the person or is it in the place?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say that it's both and that makes it complex and that makes it hard to grapple with. I think if we, especially health workers in general, tend to operate in highly stressful environments, often in toxic environments, often in environments that are under-resourced, underfunded, and that has an impact and it's undeniable. And I think when we are in environments of that kind, it's very important to cultivate an understanding of the systemic and the external factors that may cause our exhaustion, because it can be curative to realize it's not my fault. I'm not alone. You know, there are structural causes for what I am experiencing. It's not my responsibility, because exhaustion and burnout often comes with great feelings of shame and guilt. At the same time, there are also often inner causes for our exhaustion. And that can be perfectionism, that can be an overactive inner critic, can be a lot of internal noise, battles between parts of us that want different things, and it can be bad working habits. So it's very important to understand what causes our exhaustion and to be very discerning about what we can control and what we can't control.
I'm reminding hearing you speak here about, you know, some of the research which shows that not everybody who joins the military and goes off and sees combat necessarily returns with PTSD. A lot do, but many don't. So analogously, I think, are there certain vulnerabilities? You mentioned perfectionism, but whether it's a pre-existing condition or something in your personal history, can you speak a little bit more about that, about things that might put the individual factors that might put somebody at a greater risk of burnout and exhaustion?
Yeah, so I would say great risk factors are also often strengths that, you know, when overused become weaknesses. So conscientiousness and care often drive burnout. You know, when we care deeply, when we have very high ideals for what we want to do, what we want to achieve, and burnout emerged, you know, it was first diagnosed in the caring professions, where people tend to care enormously about what they do and about the outcomes of what they do. And they often burnout is theorized as emerging in that gap between our ideals and the reality of work. So conscientiousness, caring deeply, a sense of duty and responsibility, perfectionism, you know, when we have very, very high standards and when we judge ourselves very harshly, and when we have a lot of inner noise. I would say a lot of my coaching clients suffer from what I would call hyperactive inner critics. And that's an inner voice that berates us, that judges us, you know, that drags everything we achieve in the mud. You know, it's a form of self-bullying, and that can drain our energy from within, and that can be extremely dangerous. So inner noise, massive, massive factor, I would say. And then, you know, oftentimes people who have a tendency to want to please others can be at higher risk. You know, when we want to please others, when we really want to help, we find it harder to say no and to draw boundaries.
Yeah. I mean, you know, from a purely pragmatic perspective, I think everybody would probably agree that healthcare workplaces ought to be healthier themselves as places. But in the meantime, you know, surely there must be some skills that an individual can learn or bring, if it's not necessarily in their nature, into such challenging, messy human work in order to reduce their risk of exhaustion and burnout. So, you know, can you talk us through maybe some of those individual strategies or skills that can be developed to help people who might not necessarily be in an ideal environment?
Yeah. So I would say really important is to have a very clear sense of what can I control and what can't I control. It's an ancient Stoic technique, the circle of control technique, and it involves writing down our core stressors and then drawing two concentric circles, one nestling within the other on a piece of paper, and putting the stressors that are outside of our control in the outer circle and the stressors that are within our control in the inner circle. And then the ideal would be to focus most of our attention, our energy, our mental capacity on the stressors that we can control, and trying to develop more acceptance for what we cannot control. And that frees up energy because we stop worrying about what we can't change anyway. That can be a very powerful technique. I would also say, and this is counterintuitive actually, Mark, often when we're very exhausted, we tend to reduce down our energies. We tend to, our activities, sorry. We have limited amount of energy. We become very stingy and careful with that energy. And we try to cut things out of our life. And that's natural, you know, that we might want to preserve our energy in that way. But that can also be very dangerous because often we cut precisely the activities that have the capacity to re-nourish us and to re-energize us out of our lives. And that creates a vicious circle. So what I would say, and this is not facetious advice, although it might sound like it, is it's very important that we cultivate hobbies, that we have something that gives us joy and pleasure and that is outside of work, that cannot be instrumentalized in any way, and that purely has the function of making us feel alive and giving us a sense of respite. And hobbies can be completely absurd activities. They don't have to go anywhere. They don't have to result in anything. We can also be really bad at our hobbies. It doesn't matter. As long as it's not work and as long as it somehow re-nourishes us. So I would say it's very important to have some a locus of meaning, purpose, and joy that is outside of work. Because then we also become more resilient when things go badly at work, because work is not all we have. It's not the only source of purpose, meaning, and, you know, identity. It's very important to have other pockets in our lives that can give us that.
Yeah. So you're not just always singing from on one note, I guess. You know, yes. Say somebody's listening to this or watching this, and they're already burnt out. Maybe they've tried some of the strategies, or maybe they haven't. But the point is that they are where they are. What do you think needs to happen in the short term to help them recover? And then maybe in the mid to long term, you know, there's good research to show that people do better when they're back at work. Say they've had to take time off work because the workplace gives them meaning. So what do you think then they need to do both to recover and then in the mid to long term to help them get back to work?
Yeah, I would say that the first step is to really try and disentangle our conceptions of ourselves, of work, of time, and of value. Because often in people who suffer from burnout, those are all they're all entangled in ways that are not healthy. So we need to understand that we are valuable human beings outside of work, in spite of work, in spite of what happens at work. But often our identities become completely enmeshed with our work identities. And that takes some time. We often also believe in cultural narratives around time wasting and productivity that do not serve us. And recognizing what these cultural scripts are and how we can learn to spot them and defuse from them is also an essential skill. So I think when we're in the grips of burnout, we do have to do some inner work. We have to do some soul searching and look at what has caused this burnout, whether we might, you know, have perfectionist tendencies, whether we have a very strong inner critic, or whether we have problematic assumptions about our identity, our value, and time and productivity and achievement and success. And so there is soul searching involved, there is resting involved, but also reintroducing activities into our lives that make us feel alive. And in some of the most extreme cases, people find that they cannot or do not want to return to their original professions. And that is threatening, right? That's existentially very worrying and concerning, but it's also an opportunity. Burnout, as bad as it feels, is also always an opportunity for change, for getting back in touch with what we really want, what we long for, what we want to do with the next couple of decades of our lives. And sometimes that does involve career changes, especially when we're in always on environments, when we're in environments that, you know, suck out all our energy. And sometimes our bodies say no to that. And they say, up to here and no further. You need to do something else now.
Yeah, maybe the situation is no longer serving you. You know, I think that we experience these things individually, but cultures in workplaces and more broadly, I think are collections of individual people. You know, the basic unit, if you will, of a workplace is the worker. So how do you think that individual healthcare workers can best support each other sort of laterally as peers to reduce the risk of burnout and exhaustion?
Yeah, great question. I think there is scope for designing some things. Some things will not be designable, not changeable, but I think teams of healthcare workers can get together and discuss what really depletes them, what the core stressors in their working environments are together. And I often find it very useful when I work with organizations to encourage workers to draw up an anti-burnout manifesto, to really put their heads together and think about what is it that we can control, what would help us as a team, as a collective, and what can we agree upon? What can we co-create and co-design to make our working environments better? And that can be email policies, that can be synchronizing pauses, you know, having work breaks together so that there's an opportunity for human contact. And that can be much more workplace specific. But I think it's important to think about what would help us? What do we need? You know, what can we agree on as a collective here?
Along a similar sort of line, how do you think the rank and file average healthcare worker can manage up or influence their workplace leadership to improve the working conditions in such a way that it can reduce exhaustion and burnout?
Yeah, I mean, ideally it should happen the other way around, because line managers have that responsibility themselves. You know, they have a duty of care. They have to make sure that their workers don't burn out, and they have to make sure that they create the right conditions for that. And they should also role model good working practices. That often doesn't happen, unfortunately. I would say communicating is important. You know, saying, being quite specific about asks and being quite specific about little changes that might make a difference. We shouldn't underestimate the power of small interventions as well. When, you know, big systemic change isn't possible, there can still be small changes to our days that make our days better in little ways that, you know, have a compounding effect.
I mean, people leaders are people too, of course. So, you know, what do you think that whether you're the top executive or somewhere in the middle, do you think that the needs of leaders in terms of preventing exhaustion and burnout are different from the rank and file employee?
Yes, I think there, you know, I guess leadership brings its own set of psychological challenges, and leaders have responsibility for those whom they lead, And that is that brings its own stresses, absolutely. And I would say that, I mean, I guess every workplace and every role comes with its very unique challenges, and they all need to be looked at very carefully. And the key really is to get in touch with what we need, and to also think about what would make our days better, because we often think in terms of, you know, longer term stretches of time, or we live for the weekend, or we live for our next holiday. But I think just thinking about what would improve my day, my regular work day, is an important question to ask ourselves.
Either in your personal experience or in your research and writing on this front, do you think that there's one, or what would you say is the one biggest factor or most powerful element in a workplace that can help protect people from exhaustion and burnout?
Yeah, I've got an answer to that one, and that is to give and receive appreciation. And there are actually, there's research on that. And I noticed that in most of my clients, that what hurts us most and what demoralizes us most is feeling underappreciated, feeling a lack of appreciation, feeling we're not valued at work. And it's so easy to give appreciation. And again, line managers have a duty to do that. But if we don't get appreciation, we can still feel better by giving appreciation, because it actually works both ways. So making others feel appreciated can also help us feel less depleted. So I would say giving and receiving appreciation is the number one priority.
Anna Scheffner, I appreciate you. Thank you so much for joining us on Modern Minds today.
Thank you for the conversation.
We'll be right back with much more right after this.
Mental health is health. At the Institute of Living, we are pioneers in mental health, and we have been for 200 years. We have an ambition to transform mental health services while co-designing these services with those whom we serve. Together, we can reduce stigma, address discrimination, and increase access to care.
Welcome back to Modern Minds. I'm Mark Hennick. We're going to continue this conversation on healthcare worker burnout with Sarah McVannell. Sarah is an author and recognition expert, and she's here with me now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
So I want to jump right in here. We heard from Anna Scheffner just in the last segment a little bit about the individual aspects of burnout, particularly among healthcare providers. So I want to shift gears and sort of take it up a level to the organizational and the cultural level. Every now and then, I don't know if you've seen this article, but an article comes up in my LinkedIn feed from Jennifer Moss. And the title always catches me because it's called Burnout is About Your Workplace, Not About Your People. I don't know if you've ever seen that article, but I'm interested in your reaction just to that concept, you know, that it's actually outside of you, the causes of burnout. I'm wondering what your thoughts about that are, maybe what aspects of the workplace environment outside of the person might contribute to burnout among healthcare workers.
It's such an important conversation because healthcare is not only externally, the individual professional is impacted by their organization. There also is a layer of team, and there also is a layer of sector. And that sector impact can be influenced by a lot of changing things, such as look at what happened not that long ago in the US where a nurse was criminally charged. I mean, it's making people think about, how am I supposed to do my best work if I'm afraid that I am going to be potentially criminally liable if we make a mistake? And so it's really important to acknowledge and honor the external context that healthcare workers are in, because otherwise we kind of have that blame that people can feel. They're already doing the very best that they can. So I'm really looking forward to talking about how do we build cultures of recognition at a team and organizational level to help insulate against those external factors.
So, you know, when thinking about healthcare worker environments in particular, I often think about my mother. She was a nurse for 30 years. And all through my childhood, I can remember her working shift work. Often she would, later on in her career, she'd work 4 days on and 4 days off. She'd do back shifts, night shifts, sometimes day shifts. She'd be called in sometimes if there weren't enough people. So that really, in the preparing for our conversation today, made me think about the physical aspects of burnout, just how hard it is on your body to do those kinds of shifts. So, you know, I'm wondering what your thoughts about that are. What sorts of physical contributors there are to burnout, particularly in healthcare settings?
Yeah, well, we see way more musculoskeletal injuries amongst healthcare providers. I mean, if that, just that one factor alone.
Sure.
And the fact that you use an example where you remember what it was like for your mom speaks volumes about the impression that families, the public, family members, patients have about how hard the work is. So that's not really much of a recruitment strategy when people can remember an entire, you know, lifetime that your amazing mom donated and, you know, dedicated to her career. And one of your biggest memories is, oh my gosh, my mom worked so hard, so many hours. She was so tired. It was so hard on her body. So we need to maybe be as public about how do we take care of our healthcare professionals as well? A small example of that is educating families about how they can help. So by being part of the care, that's a way of reducing the physical burden on our care professionals and not being afraid to ask for them to be part of that. It could be the importance of acknowledging that our donors need to donate for things like lifts. It's a lot of people don't realize that our healthcare system requires donations for equipment to be able to provide care. So I, you know, it's funny how we went right into the physical dimensions of burnout when we're talking about organizational. What kind of organizational choices can we make? And can we encourage a conversation beyond the doors of the hospital to try to understand how to make life less taxing on our providers?
You know, I'm thinking of it's somewhat unrelated, but in a similar vein, how in a number of jurisdictions, first responders are starting to get the right to claim disability insurance for PTSD. And why I think that relates here is because one of the counter arguments to that before these legislation started to change was that trauma is just part of the job. If you're going to be a first responder, you're going to get traumatized in the line of work. That's, of course, in my view, not a tenable argument. It makes me wonder.
Firefighters are going to get burned. Don't complain about it.
Exactly. You know? But that brings it into the healthcare type conversation, though, where maybe there's an argument that shift work is just part of the job, or, you know, stress, musculoskeletal stress injuries are going to be just part of the job. Is it, though? Can workplaces at the cultural and management level change that perception of what it means to be a healthcare worker?
We definitely need to acknowledge it. And given that when they study shift work, people who work shifts, and this is not just healthcare, they live on average 5 years less per year. So that is a big investment. That is a huge commitment. That is a lifelong commitment besides the number of years people are working in their profession. So when we think about our attendance management, when we think about how we call in people, when we look at making sure that there are spaces for rest, that the break room is not five floors up, that it's, we actually have a space where people can take their 15-minute and they need to get their 15-minute break, and that it doesn't take as long to get to the break room as it does to actually have the break. So these are some things that we can think about, because goodness knows, folks are having their bodies, it's a full-on commitment to be able to do this work. And there is a toll that their bodies take and their longevity takes. So what can we do in the environment? What can we do in how we organize our workflow? What can we do when we look at maybe not overburdening somebody who's been doing all of the onboarding and all of the training, who might not get their break because they've got a new staff member that they're trying to mentor? We need to look at the big picture. And I love how you're asking the question about health, because I don't think we often look at that. We look at the organizational processes, the demands of the day. We get super tactical. What do we need to get done this shift? It's an important conversation to pull back and say, what's the risk to individuals, to teams, to organizations, and frankly, to make this field, whichever field within healthcare, actually appealing for people to belong to.
Now, another big piece of this, of course, we've been talking about the physical demands of these sorts of jobs, but there's certainly on the mental front and the emotional front, you can't help but not think of compassion fatigue. You know, it's mentally and emotionally taxing just to carry around other people suffering with you. So what are your thoughts on how that contributes to burnout among healthcare workers, the mental load of the work that they're doing?
The fact that we're talking about burnout and compassion fatigue is such an important place to start, because the burnout is what happens when we are taxed and we're overwhelmed. When we add the trauma or vicarious trauma to the already those burnout conditions, that's where we hit compassion fatigue. I actually have on my website, greatnessmagnified.com, under the cool stuff page, I actually have a resource on noticing the signs from compassion satisfaction into the warning signs we're slipping into compassion fatigue to being in compassion fatigue at many levels, the social, the psychological, the physical. And so if nothing else, having resources like that to check in, and that there being no shame. Yes, we normalize that we're all going to experience difficult things. That's part of the job. Absolutely. But just like your example with the paramedics, it may be part of the job, but it doesn't necessarily need to be something that we don't attend to and we take care of. So one thing is to educate. What are the signs of satisfaction compared to fatigue? And what are the signs we're slipping from one to the next? And then if we see that this is happening, knowing that the surface signs may be things like lack of collaboration, sick time, turnover. We think that these are, you know, maybe something that we can point to a group of people as not being dedicated, or that this is not a great place to work. There probably are roots that go back to situations of compassion fatigue where we've not noticed the signs early enough. We would never let a patient have warning signs of diabetes and say, well, the sugars are high, but they're not that high. It's okay. No, we would start educating them. We would encourage a healthier diet and talk about exercise. And we would, you know, maybe suggest that they come back for monitoring. And the earliest signs that that is really dangerous, we're going to say your kidneys are at risk. You're like, and this is going to impact your whole body. And by the way, your whole family is going to be impacted by this. We need to take this really seriously. We need to treat compassion fatigue the same level of seriousness as we would a patient with a serious chronic illness. Just because it's in their family history as a very strong predictor they're going to have diabetes doesn't mean to say we say, well, I guess there's nothing you can do about it because it seems like everybody has it. We would take it seriously. We need to do the same for our providers.
I think related to this, I want to ask you about the idea of moral injury, which I think, you know, that term has been coming up a lot. And in my mind, and I'm not an expert on that area by any means, but it seems to be something that arises when you're asked to do work that doesn't align with your values or who you are as a person. You know, and I think that people in healthcare maybe are exposed to that more than others. What's your understanding of that idea of moral injury and maybe how it contributes to that additional tax that are put on people in the healthcare space?
I'm not an expert as well. I do remember my days in healthcare, however, where ethics experts would be available to providers, and we would almost hesitate to tap into those resources. Again, it's one of those normalized things that we assume that there'll be ethical dilemmas. We assume that there will be those circumstances that are difficult. And yet the resources are there. We need to tap into them. And maybe we need to, somebody who is noticing it from the outside. It could be the health and safety person who's noticing an upsurge in their claims, or people who are experiencing injuries or maybe strain, emotional, mental health strain related to the work that they're doing. If it seems like there could be a very strong disconnect with values, such as, you know, you need to take care of that patient, and it doesn't matter, you know, if they're treating you badly. Sorry, you've got to take care of them. I mean, you know, we have a duty of care. And we also need to realize that there are circumstances where individuals, the way they're being treated, they would never put up with that somewhere else. So being aware of it, sometimes it's people outside of that particular caregiving relationship who would notice some of those moral and ethical dilemmas. What resources are available to people? Spiritual care was one in our organization that we tapped into a lot when healthcare providers were struggling to rectify. And it could be things like on a racial front, on a gender-based front, on an intergenerational front. Ageism happens every time we say, oh, those millennials. You know, so we need to look at what access we have around us to try to wade through the muckiness that is part of the delicacy of the healthcare field. So again, I'm not an expert. I'm not sure if that helps, but we have resources and organizations and we need to leverage them.
Yeah. But, and you did though start out there by mentioning the health and safety angle on this. And often I don't think we still don't really talk about the mental health aspects of work in a sort of health and safety kind of lens. A number of countries now have national standards for psychological health and safety in the workplace. But it's still not, I don't think it's still widespread yet. So, you know, how do you think then that, or what ways in which does mental health fit into that sort of health and safety realm, which seems to be kind of separate in many workplaces?
Yeah. Well, one of the most important preventative mechanisms that we have, and this relates to everything we've been talking about, and that is recognition. And you can see by what you just put on below me here is that I'm a recognition expert. And from having done either myself or teams that I work with, and then of course working with folks outside of an organization, hospitals, we found that every team that was imploding, every team that was experiencing mental strain, physical strain, relationship strain, and even patient care strain, when recognition was missing, it wasn't happening interpersonally. It chipped away at people's ability to provide great care, to collaborate, to be a good team colleague. They were hesitant to report safety incidents. There was disengagement. And we all know that those things are dangerous for our patients. And they're also dangerous for losing providers and them choosing to leave a team, an organization, and even the sector. So recognition, whether it be one-on-one, in fact, Mark, I'm curious, I have to ask you this question. I ask this question of every audience. If there was one form of recognition that you could receive for the rest of your life, no matter where it was, whether it was at home, with your friends, at work, your podcast guests, or you know, people listening to your podcast, what is the most important form of recognition for you?
For me? Oh, that's an interesting question. And a number of things went through my mind as you were speaking, but I don't know if this counts as recognition or not. You could tell me, you're the expert, but one of the things that I love about the work that I'm doing up here in Canada now with our national public broadcaster is that I feel like I have an employer that is really invested in and interested in my growth and development as a professional, as, you know, I feel like I have champions for me in the workplace. And that makes me feel really good to think that I have somebody on my side. Does that count?
I love it. Champions for me, when you said those words, it gave me goosebumps. Yeah. And, you know, one of the dimensions that any engagement survey includes, in fact, it's part of the Gallup 12. So in other words, if you ask 12 questions to measure engagement, Gallup has identified the 12 most important. And one of them is around, I have people who champion my development and growth, and I have opportunities. In fact, I think that that's even spliced into two questions. Don't quote me on that. I am not Ms. Gallup. The point is, what you just shared is actually key to measuring engagement. And part of why what I'm hearing from you is you need people to see you for who you are, not just for what you can do for the organization. You need somebody to see you and understand you well enough to realize that you have potential, what you might be capable of, to encourage you to strive for those things. They're not limiting you. They're not gossiping about you. They're not restricting your access to be able to do the things that add meaning and spirit to you. And when you think about recognition in an organization, that's probably what we really want for people, right? Is we want people to see that they can grow in this organization, that they're individually valued, that they're a valuable part of the team, that they're not just a number, they're not just a role, they're not just a badge with a number on it. And unfortunately, that's what a lot of people feel in healthcare. So the easiest thing that we can all do in healthcare to help prevent burnout and to truly notice some of the early signs, as well as to insulate against the strain and the pain that is normally part of such an intense caring profession, is to say thank you, is to acknowledge something seemingly small that an individual might do. Of course they would do it. That's part of their job. However, it's their unique footprint, their blueprint about what impact looks like. And so just because they do it consistently, regularly, easily, doesn't necessarily mean we shouldn't acknowledge it. In fact, what gets appreciated gets repeated. So if we want that person to continue to always take an extra couple of minutes with a senior to say, thank you so much, dear, for, you know, trying to get up and go to the bathroom. You know, you're so brave. And that person's like, of course, I would want anyone to treat my grandmother that way. Of course. However, not everybody probably gives them the benefit of the doubt and says something so sweet and so lovely in their own little way. And that's an exact example I remember from an incredible nurse who loved caring for seniors, and not all of her colleagues did. So another colleague, what she really valued was efficiency. So people saying, you know what, when you're on shift, when I'm on shift with you, things happen. This communication station's organized. Every patient gets seen to by 11 o'clock. Our med rec is done. So, and that it's quality and efficiency is important for that person. So we need to look for and be curious about what matters to each person. And if for you, in your case, it's probably, wow, you are clearly an accomplished reader. You're hosting this podcast. You're always curious and learning from new guests. You're on LinkedIn all the time. Wow, Mark, you are a savvy learner and you're really committed to your development. I have so much to learn from you. I'm sure that would be something that you would want somebody to acknowledge in you, because that's who you are. I'm guessing that'd be fair to say.
I think it would be fair, but it would also be uncomfortable to hear.
Oh, yes. Okay. Well, there you go. You're welcome for making you uncomfortable in your own podcast.
Thank you. No, not at all. I do appreciate
you. You raise a good point though, Mark. I'm so glad that you said that. Well, Brené Brown would be so proud of you. I'm so glad that you shared that it's a bit uncomfortable, because this is actually one of the reasons why people hold back of sharing what they think is great about other people, because they would feel uncomfortable about being acknowledged. So they don't want to make somebody else feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And even if you think that person might be okay with it, I might worry about it's going to come across as sincere, or I've missed my window, or maybe I don't know them well enough. I hear all the time when I deliver keynotes, when I do training sessions, and this is particularly pronounced of our incredibly humble, very patient and person-centric providers, whether it be healthcare, developmental services, childcare, et cetera, we're so humble that we feel almost that we're uncomfortable getting compliments. I'm here for the work. I'm here to care. I'm here for other people. Yes. And if you don't feel resourceful enough, if you don't feel like your greatness is being valued, and oh my gosh, if you do not see your greatness, particularly in those tough shifts, when you're understaffed, when you're feeling burnt out and possibly compassion fatigued, knowing what your greatness is, all of my healthcare friends, lean in. When you know what your greatness is and you receive people's acknowledgement of it, whether it be a patient letter, whether it be your family members being in awe, just like you, Mark, were of your mom, whether it be your colleagues saying something nice to you, please let it sink into your skin and into your mind. You talked about mental health, Mark. You talked about physical health, and we've talked about the health of the professions that, you know, of folks who will be watching this. One of the most important things that I encourage people to perhaps get uncomfortable with in order to, for your own mental health well-being and that of your provider is able to receive acknowledgments, compliments, and then to be able to give them. I think if we did that, I know from having written many books, from having spoken for thousands and thousands of providers, and from having done over 100 team consultations in healthcare, I can tell you with absolute certainty, the only thing that I know would help a team within minutes is helping people feel more comfortable and more and doing more of this, a recognition of yourself and each other. So if there's one thing I can leave folks with that's going to somehow help at an individual, an interpersonal, a team, an organizational, and a system level, it's recognition, one act at a time.
Sarah McVannell, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining me on Modern Minds today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We're going to hand it over to Brian in the field now just for a few more comments about this from the Hartford Healthcare Campus in Hartford. Brian, over to you.
Thank you, Mark. We are going to continue this conversation centered around worker wellness. Here to discuss is Dr. Jennifer Ferrand, Director of the Hartford Healthcare Wellbeing Department. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
So we talk about stress a lot in general. What kind of defines stress?
I would define stress as anything that places a demand on you emotionally or physically that also taxes your resources or your ability to cope.
And we know a lot of people are dealing with stress in their life right now. Let's talk about specifically healthcare workers. What kinds of stressors do healthcare workers, you know, often experience?
So they can face some unique stressors. Most healthcare workers are working in situations that can really be intense and emotionally draining, right? We're facing illness, injury, death, and dying. And those can be perceived as almost traumatic stress injuries. But we can also face grief injuries related to the loss of people and parts of ourselves, or moral injuries related to a sense of inner conflict when we might have to do things at work that aren't aligned with our values, or we aren't able to do things at work that we feel we need to do. And fatigue injuries, which is really the accumulation of a number of stressors over time without sufficient time to rest or recover.
So a lot of different stressors
wrapped
up in it all. All right, I want to talk about burnout rates, because it's something that's very real and we've heard about it a lot, especially, you know, during the COVID-19 pandemic. So what are some of the burnout rates among physicians, nurses, and other healthcare professionals?
Well, I'll start by saying that burnout is really an occupational phenomenon, and it's defined by a couple of different symptoms. One is reduced effectiveness at work. One is emotional exhaustion. And one is a sense of distance or detachment from your work. It's a hard thing to study, but there have been studies that have shown that various groups of healthcare workers, including nurses and physicians, have experienced about a 30% increase in burnout over the pandemic, so that we're now at around 60+% of healthcare workers we think are experiencing burnout at any given time.
So I just want to emphasize that. So an additional 30%
of burnout. 30%.
So that is a big number.
Yes.
All right. So a lot of burnout obviously happening. How does having access to therapy help many of these individuals who are experiencing these stressors and this burnout?
Mm-hmm. Well, we think that the best ways we can support the mental health of the healthcare workforce mm-hmm. is by reducing the stigma associated with mental health problems, increasing access to mental health care, and decreasing some of the stressors that the healthcare workforce is experiencing. And psychotherapy is one part of the mix, right? I like to talk about psychotherapy as mental health care, although a lot of people think of it as mental illness care, right? But I think that it's really just something that we should all be doing to optimize our health and not just something we pursue when we're not well.
Right. And the term therapy can really encompass a lot of different things. It's not just speaking with a therapist one-on-one. If you can elaborate on that, there's some different things
Sure. I mean, I love talk therapy. I do a lot of talk therapy. Yep. There's so much value to it. It's really, really important. It allows to forge a connection with somebody.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there are lots of other things that we can do that are therapeutic, right? Having a relaxation or meditation practice, having a physical activity regimen that you do routinely, doing things with other people that are fun. All of these activities can be therapeutic.
And so there's different types of therapies, which is good.
I think.
So, you know, in closing here, what's the biggest way that we can help healthcare workers out there who are experiencing all of these different things we're talking about?
I think that it really all boils down to compassion and connection. We as healthcare workers need to treat ourselves with compassion and help, and we need to be able to identify when we're suffering or when we have a stress injury. We have to know how to get help for it and who to ask for help. And we have to make efforts to connect with each other because we're really having a shared experience. And the healthcare organization or the industry has to create cultures that allow people to do this, that allow people to identify when they're distressed and seek support and connect with each other.
And one of the things I think you just hinted on is people should know they're not alone. There's a lot of people who are experiencing these types of stressors, the burnout, all of that stuff. So it's something we're all experiencing at one point or the other.
Yeah.
All right, Dr. Jennifer Fran, thank you so much. A lot of great perspective on all of this. And with that said, Mark, we will send it back to you.
Thanks, Brian. Well, that's all that we have time for on this episode of Modern Minds. Many thanks to Anna Schaffner and Sarah McVannell for joining me on the show today. Let me know your thoughts about what you heard. You can connect with me on LinkedIn, Facebook, X, and YouTube at Mark Hennick. That's at MarkHennick. You can also go to modernmindspod.com to get all of our past episodes, including conversations on deprescribing, teen mental health, recovery-oriented architecture, and a lot more. Make sure that you hit that subscribe button on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you're watching or listening to Modern Minds. That's going to make sure that you're the first to know when the next new episode is up. So watch for the new conversation that we have coming about involuntary treatment. That's an important one. It's going to be an interesting one, and it'll be posted next. So until then, I've been Mark Hennick, and this has been Modern Minds.